This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Ian Thomas and Laura Hall. Ian is a writer, designer, and programmer. He's worked on such games as Soma, the Lego games, the Little Big Planet series, and has also produced work for film, VR, and live-action events. Laura is a writer and game designer who has worked on such projects as the escape room Spark of Resistance, Disforgiveness, and Cup of Quest. She's currently writing a book about Katamari Damacy for Boss Fight Books. Thank you for coming on the show, you two.
Thanks for having me.
Ian, we'll start off with you. How did you break into games?
Oh, long and convoluted route. So I'd spent probably about 15 years doing other things, amongst other things, running a mask and puppet making company, working on interactive TV in the early days of Sky, and eventually ended up running an edutainment company for kind of 7 years, games for really young kids, kind of threes to kind of seven-year-olds. And we got caught in that loop of never quite having enough funding because it was government funding coming in and producing software, which we weren't 100% happy with because we couldn't spend the time. And I think I just had enough of that and finally went, you know, I always wanted to be, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be in the games industry. I've been a programmer for years. I'm doing all of this writing and designing in my spare time and I have no time to sleep. Can I somehow compress all of that into a day job? And just took a chance, took a big leap, and found a company that would take me if I drove for kind of 4 hours up at the beginning of the week and 4 hours back again, and kind of taken off since. I mean, I'm in a part of the UK which hasn't historically had a lot of games, so it was a bit of a leap of faith, but thanks to the wonders of the internet and working from home, it's really taken off over the last 5 years. It's just transformed into something that I can actually do here in my office, as I guess the rest of you guys know.
Yeah.
How did you get that first job?
I don't know, persistence. My skills, other than programming at kind of really low level for things like the interactive TV, my skills had at that point got to things like team management, things like scheduling, project management, as well as the coding, kind of team leadership stuff, as well as the creative stuff. And I think they were really looking for somebody to fill partly a programmer, but partly a project management role, kind of in the middle of it. And so their goal was to move me up to that role, having put me in as a programmer. But it was, I won't name the company, but it was my kind of baptism by fire into learning what really big companies in the games industry can work like in terms of crunch and all the rest of it. Frankly, that management wasn't really something that interested me, that kind of almost slave driving from time to time as you hit the end of projects. So the whole, you know, driving across the country just wasn't working out. So jumped onto something else, really, and something else which let me do a bit more of the creative stuff. And every job move since has been dialing back on the programming a bit and dialing up the writing until I'm about to go pretty much all writing and design with little bits of coding on the side.
Has your background with management helped with any of your work, like at least with understanding how to deal with management?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's been really interesting coming from a more mainstream software industry to start with, seeing the games industry wake up and kind of realize that it has to care about this stuff, realizing that it isn't an informal thing and that people need to start thinking about it. I'm not one of these people who's utterly driven by scheduling or anything like that. It's just interesting to see people start to adopt things like Agile and kind of go, oh, maybe there's a way of planning this stuff out which doesn't involve us kind of working quite casually for 4/5 of the project and then panicking for the last fifth. And it's interesting to see people go through that kind of birthing pain. So I've been able to help with particularly smaller companies in going, well, this is kind of how we introduced it to our companies. This is how we grew a team from like 5 people to 35 people in a previous industry. And maybe this experience has a bit of bearing on what you're doing. And that's worked kind of well, really.
Cool. This is not related to games that much, but you said you used to run a mask and puppet making company?
Yeah. My brother's crazy idea, I was just out of university. He'd been building props for films for a while. And we'd both been into live role playing for years and building props and costumes. And we thought, well, let's try making some money out of this. He does amazing creatures and costumes. And I was kind of, I can do bits and pieces. I'm nothing like as good as him. And we had nothing else to do. We're in the middle of nowhere with no other jobs to get. And we kind of went, let's try it. We can get a bit of money in from local government and see what happens. And it was a spectacular failure in terms of finances, but it was amazing fun. I mean, throwing expanding foam all over the place, stuffing very low paid volunteers into monster costumes and painting them while they were in them, you know, that kind of thing. But it very much, I guess it's kind of a bit like the games industry in that what we discovered is that to make money, we had to make a whole load of cookie cutter things that were just the same as the last thing. And that wasn't interesting. That's a kind of almost a factory job, really. Whereas we wanted to make one-off amazing things and no one was prepared to pay for that. So we called it a day, but it was all really, really good experience.
Rad.
Oh, that's so cool.
How'd you break into games, Laura?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I guess... If I consider myself to be semi in games, I'm certainly involved in them, but I don't work in them in a sort of like mainstream professional sense, I guess. A lot of my work is sort of within the realm of like art or with our escape room that we run. That isn't my full-time job. So it was created when I was at a different job. So it was kind of almost a hobby project, but, to answer your question, I have always played games, mostly online. I grew up in a sort of small, conservative part of Texas. And so I spent a lot of time on the internet. I didn't really fit in there. And I used to play games on our sort of local dial-up BBS. I played Door Games, Legend of the Red Dragon on there. Then I got really hooked on a multi-user dungeon called Achaea. For years. And so that's all text-based sort of fantasy role play. But that game the things that I really enjoyed about that game are things that I've enjoyed about games culture in general. It facilitated the creation of arts and culture and politics within the world that whole thing was set in. And so I got really heavily involved in that. And it was very much about the community of players, people logging in every night who was actually truly there. And so then eventually I got really interested in alternate reality games, sort of the first of those genre were I Love Bees and The Beast, which were promotional material for Halo and the movie AI. But those were sort of massive online puzzle games where players would come and there was like a team of writers who were working behind the scenes in character, and they would create a story world. So it was all of these puzzles and websites and emails and things, and you were constantly interacting with this fictional world. And the idea is that it could at any time sort of break into your real life. It's sort of like tonally inspired by that Michael Douglas movie called The Game. And like there's this scene where he's walking down the street and this payphone rings and it's for him. And it's just like this totally amazing moment. And so those were what those games were always striving for. Like the tag for those that the players made is, this is not a game, right? It's part of your real life. But there was something really beautiful and ephemeral about that. Like you can go and read about all of the stuff that happened in those, but you can never recreate it or re-experience it. It was something that was completely dependent on the people that were coming together at the time, collaborating in real time to solve these things. And then, you know, the story was also very malleable. Like the team behind the scenes was changing stuff, interacting as characters, but very much based on the sort of desires and needs and actions of the community at the time. So it was this really interesting sort of symbiotic thing that was happening, but also very heavily puzzle-based. So I had played those for a really long time when I was in school and just after. And I, you know, they sort of died down around the time that I was, I guess, aging out of them and sort of entering the workforce and stuff, in a way that meant I did not have the hours necessary to dedicate to them. So I sort of, for a while, had this gap of, you know, I was making things and sort of playing around in playful spaces, but not in games, as it were. And then I sort of found both immersive theater and escape room games sort of within the same time span. And I got really into puzzle solving in a competitive sense. There's an event here in Portland where I live called Puzzled Pint. It's actually now a global event, but it started here. And it's this monthly puzzle thing. You solve puzzles, you go drink beer, you solve more puzzles. And before that moment, even though I had participated in these sort of like very complicated puzzling events, I didn't think of myself as a puzzle person until we started going to day-long competitions and week-long competitions, and we started practicing and developing our skills. And there's a whole world of puzzles that integrate with narrative within this sort of sphere, and people who are really interested in that stuff. And one of the ways that's expressing itself now is in escape room games. So a bunch of us who are theater people and writers and game designers and stuff, we ended up making one here just to see if we could, kind of. And that has actually turned out really well. And that same team of people originally, almost everybody from that has moved away. But we were doing game jams together and, you know, making board games. And since then, that's sort of how I got into it. I would even say sort of in a formal sense in the game scene within the last few years, even. But I've been doing those game jams and going to events and stuff, running this puzzle thing.
What did you go to school for?
I did English literature, and then I ended up spending 99% of my time doing student journalism. Yeah, so all nonfiction. I mean, there's a narrative in that, and it's like very interesting and important to like do story structure within those. Yeah, so I should mention, I've always done writing on the side. And journalism was like a really interesting way of focusing that energy for me. And so now, I'm doing the book about Katamari just because it's such an interesting story about the development of that game. I'm very interested in the creative process for people who sort of don't quite fit in. And that's very much Keita Takahashi as an artist. And like, it's kind of a miracle that Katamari got made at all. And it's just like at every single turn, it sort of shouldn't exist, but somehow it does.
I wanted to ask, like, what is your background with writing and like narrative?
I mean, I guess it's always something that I've been drawn to. When I was very, very small, I was taught to read at a very early age, and sort of that was what my parents used as a reward for me, or a punishment, was like allowing me to read or taking books away from me. So I think that sort of like hardwired that in. I can't actually remember a time in my life when I wasn't writing, and I have a bunch of the stories that I wrote when I was a kid, and they're really strange and sort of fantastical, but it's always been something that I've done. I never considered not doing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Are there ones that you want to make in new games?
Yeah. Well, the one that is my favorite is about Bad Mindy and the Eyeball Gang, which is a bank robbing girl gang. And their leader is named Elizabeth, but they all call her Sir. It's really, really hilarious. And I think that would make a really good game, actually.
Make it.
Yeah. Eventually.
And Ian, what's your history with writing?
A bit of a mishmash, really. Again, I was the kind of kid who would fail to go to classes because I was in the library reading a good book and had completely missed the bell, you know. So I was brought up on you know, always with a book in my hand. But mostly I think it comes out of role-playing, like so many games writers, and in particular writing and designing small-scale to very large-scale live role-playing events. And then as I kind of started to realize that the work we were putting into those was the equivalent of, for example, a TV series, starting to study how those kind of things were put together. At the same time, my brother was getting into film, so I started writing film scripts alongside with him and studying that. And it's just kind of grown since, writing books, writing kind of kids' graphic novels about Cthulhu, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And really, it's just things that I quite like trying out. That's where it came from. There's nothing stopping anyone from writing a book. There's nothing stopping anyone from writing a film, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just built up this library of stuff, which eventually started to mature and people started to publish or would make the film or would, you know, start letting me edit games or write story for games. And then gradually it kind of grew to become a hobby which turned into a career, which is fantastic, really. Slow burn.
Yeah. What's your writing process like?
The process that I mostly use is something that I'm kind of loosely these days calling moment-driven story design, I guess, which is something we developed by accident while we were creating live role-playing events. And it kind of, we started applying it to other things, and then I started applying it to things like games, and it just kind of makes sense. And I'm not claiming by any means it's a unique thing. It's just something we evolved. And then when we started to talk to people about it, discovered that actually maybe people didn't do it this way. But it comes from the realization that what we are in creating things for, what myself and the guys that I mostly work with are in these things for, are the moments when people are sitting around a table in a bar talking about an experience they've had, and going, do you remember that bit? Wasn't that bit amazing? Or this thing happened to me, and recounting these little war stories. And that started, as I said, from a kind of live role-playing and role-playing part of things. But then we realized that this actually is the same kind of moment as you get when you're sitting in the cinema discussing the Avengers and somebody's going, that bit where he punched, where the Hulk punches Thor. You know, and these are the things that people take away from these experiences. And so what we're trying to do is building events around those moments rather than necessarily looking at standard dramatic arcs, rather than necessarily looking at kind of act structures. And those things can fit into what we're doing. And often when you assemble these moments in some sort of order, you get the arcs and the acts, and you can see where they all go. But what we do for anything these days, it's computer games. Back then it was live role playing events, was to sit there and just throw a whole bunch of these ideas into the pot. So say this game's themed around this particular thing, say a pulp action adventure like Indiana Jones. Okay, so what are the things that happen in this? How can we make for somebody who's playing, living this, how can we give them that experience? Well, there'll be the moment when they have to unearth an ancient tomb and kind of crack the doors open, and there'll be a moment when they have to sit and listen to an archaeologist give a little story. There's a moment when they have to do that red line thing across the map with the plane. All these kind of moments. So how do we do those moments? And then we have the stunt team and the art team, and they'll go, oh, we want to do this. And we'll go, well, we haven't got room in the story, but it sounds amazing, let's do that. And then we'll take those the moments which we feel really kind of embody the theme of what we're trying to do, and put them into an order and wrap the story around that. And what I've kind of found is, it's probably a bit of a stupid thing to say, but the connective tissue almost doesn't matter. Obviously it matters, but if you don't have those moments, people tend to come away without anything memorable from it. It's kind of a blur. But if you've got those high points, and I'm not talking in a kind of Michael Bay way, it could be you know, a really small emotional moment between a couple of characters. It could be anything, really. But the important thing is that they go through a real emotional punch of some sort, or a moment of surprise, or a whatever. And those are the things that stick with people. If we can get that, the rest of it kind of just comes around that, just all kind of builds and grows around that. So as I said, that kind of grew out of live role playing, and so was very much targeted at player experience, which is, I think, so a really good fit for computer games. But we found ourselves doing the same thing on kind of film structure and book structure, and then, as I said, going back to things like the standard film dramatic structure and seeing where we can put the highs and lows, if that makes sense.
The building around moments sounds really interesting to me, because upon first hearing it, it makes me wonder if there's a problem with making everything feel substantial. Because at first I was thinking, are you relying on the audience to fill in the blanks? But it sounds like that's not really a problem.
No, what you're doing. No, you do. I mean, you do fill in the blanks. Obviously, you write the moments, but then you need to make them all make sense. You need to make the character motivations make sense. You need to write that connective tissue. But the key thing really is to start from the moments and then use that as a skeleton to hang the rest of the thing on. Except, I guess, when it comes to live role-playing and role-playing, I mean, you do need that in between writing. But obviously, because you've got player agency in those moments could end up in any order. Not in any order, but it can be quite loose. Some of them might never happen. Some of them you might give them all of the opportunity to hope it happens and it never does. Some of them you might go, that's a brilliant thing. They've not quite made it happen, so let's move it 2 days from now and do it then instead when we've set up the plot in a different way. So there's a lot of messing around with it, but it just gives you the skeleton to hang everything else off, and it keeps people like the stunt team and the art team happy.
Okay. And Laura, what's your writing process like?
Well, it's funny because for a lot of our stuff, we actually are also designing around player moments, in particular for the writing of the escape room stuff. So it's a very highly structured experience for players. You're sort of ushering through this story. Are you familiar with the concept of puzzle rooms? I should ask that first.
Yeah,
like different absolutely. Than escape rooms?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, you just sort of, you enter into the space, it's sort of dressed in a realistic way. You have generally an hour to get out. You're there with other people, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So generally, you know, you go into these spaces, and I should say that the ones that I've played, I've done a lot of them at this point, just, you know, because that's our hobby. Like, we do them competitively. It's for fun. And I have not really played many that are narrative at all. Generally, what's considered narrative is you go into a place, there's like furniture in there, and you're often just given a piece of paper that has pieces of a story written out on it. You know, a diary entry or something. Largely nothing is diegetic. And, you know, that's fine. Like, the puzzles are generally really solid. It's a fun experience. But because of our background in, you know, immersive theater and stuff, we really thought we could achieve something more interesting than that, and sort of just like taking people through it as if it was an actual game, right? Using the environment to tell the story, sort of calling upon subconscious visual cues. So a lot of the experience that we've designed for people is based around what we called hero moments, but it's the same thing from LARPing. That term is called froth, when people are making up their own story collaboratively after the fact, when they're like, oh my gosh, you did this cool thing, and I was over here and I was solving this thing, and, you know, when we brought that together, it was amazing. Like, that was the sort of thing that we wanted to evoke in people, and we wanted to give them those moments within the structure, because again, it's very highly structured, and allow them to sort of have that experience of fun rather than just like, you solved this and then you did this and then you're done. It can be so much more than all of the ones that we had played until that point. So yeah, I mean, it's just, it very much comes from a video game design place where everything is sort of visually indicated, or like a really solid puzzle design. The puzzle itself should tell you how to solve it, you know, within its design and style, and all of the indications should be there. Like, you shouldn't really need anything external. And so, like, in our stuff, everything comes from within this story world. And so a lot of the challenges of that were like, how do you convey both a plot, you know, something that you as the player are moving through, and sort of like a larger narrative of like, what is this world? And, you know, you're interacting with this character and who are they, without just dropping a piece of paper into the room. So during the play session, people sort of enter into this flow state, right? Like, their adrenaline is up, and like, as soon as they get in there, you know, they see that the clock is going. And so like, there's this sort of, I don't want to call it pulse pounding, but people definitely enter into this flow, where their attention is like very focused. And in that way, it's almost sports-like, like, you know, that you've got your goal and you're just going. So like, in that situation, especially as well, if you're asking people to work against a clock, like, first of all, I don't necessarily think it's fair to the player to like throw stuff at them that makes them stop and takes away from their time. But also, people just straight up don't absorb any of that information. Like, if you're reading it, you're like, yeah, okay, what do I need to know right now? So then challenge became like, how do you have people actually interact with this character without doing that to them, and sort of making it in a meaningful way? And so a lot of that actually is asking them to fill in the blanks themselves. So like we used themes from film and set design to sort of evoke people's sensation of, you know, what does a sort of Soviet office look like? You know, if you picture an actual physical office, it's like fluorescent lights and like maybe a messy desk and like a crappy chair, but that's not interesting. So we kind of designed it around what people's memory of an office might be. And we looked at a lot of films that were sort of set in either Soviet or dystopian sort of environments and like what colors did they use? What sort of visual cues did they use? And, you know, a lot of them kind of evoke industrial scenarios. So like based on a very deep understanding of what the story world was, we tried to put in things that would tell the story without actually writing it out. You know, it tells it in the design. But you are totally relying on people's subconscious to like do a lot of the heavy lifting in that scenario.
That, I think that's kind of critical in any of these things. It's something which has been hammered home more and more often. The more things I discover, really, is that concept of leaving gaps and the concept of letting the players do the heavy lifting in their own heads. I mean, obviously, at the moment, I'm working a lot with Frictional Games, who do a lot of horror. And there's so much in horror that you have to, well, not you have to, but it's so much more powerful when you get the player building up a concept of where this thing is and what it is and how it might affect them inside their own heads, so much more than you can do with actually showing it. It's like Jaws. It's back to Jaws again, or Alien. But yeah, that gap seems to turn up everywhere throughout anything interactive is when you have those gaps and when players fill them in. I don't know if you guys know Alexis Kennedy from Fallen London. You know Fallen London? Yeah. So Alexis has this thing about fires in the desert. They tell their stories through little kind of nuggets of story and don't explain how the player got from one place to another place, kind of the little fires in the desert, and then it's entirely up to the player to fill out that gap between. And obviously anybody's experience can be completely different from somebody else's because of that.
I forget, I want to go back to Laura. You said that most escape rooms that you've encountered don't do narratives at all.
They sort of take a stab in the general direction. And I don't want to say that all of them are like this, because I've played some that are really, really solid and like, you know, very well designed. There are only a couple that when the sort of discussion of escape rooms with narrative sort of baked in comes up, and I haven't actually gotten to do a lot of them, which, you know, that's the problem, because they're geographically locked. So it's just a matter of like the next time I'm in San Francisco or New York, sort of getting there. But I have never encountered one that is doing it in the same way that we did it. And, you know, we did it just because we were like, well, we should at least try, you know. These are very, very new in the sense that these specific builds are happening. They rely on a lot of the sort of storytelling that you see in theme park design, museum curation, and very heavily haunted houses, like anything where you're moving people through a physical space and sort of trying to like bring them into a story. In the case of theme parks and haunted houses, of course, like you're generally being ushered, always moving forward. And in escape rooms, you're generally either like in the same spaces or you move forward through a space and then backward out the door again. So it is a little different, but it sort of relies on a lot of the same techniques of that. But like as an example, all of our objects are moving you forward in this story of this sort of dystopian society where censorship is a big thing. And so as you are getting through the room, your clearance level is getting higher and higher and you're getting more and more access to information. What that ends up looking like is there's a set of banned books that are locked behind this thing and you suddenly have access to them, or you have a key card that gives you access to this other thing. So it's not, you know, you're not suddenly like, here's a huge load of propaganda slogans that you have to sift through. It's always, you've gained this access, but you may not even as a player be consciously aware of that. It just is, it's how it's designed. But you're always being shoved forward to the next thing in that way. They do exist though. A lot of them, you know, why the things that we considered were like, what are the reasons that you're actually in the room for an hour, for example, right? Like in hours, you have to talk your way past a secretary at the beginning who is willing to go on a lunch break just for an hour. And if you're not out of there by the time they're back, we're all going to be in trouble, that sort of thing. You know, and some of them are flimsier, right? Like there's a serial killer and they're playing a game with you and you have an hour, so go, my puppets, kind of stuff of that nature. Some of them, you know.
To say the ones I've played over here, and I've only played a couple, are even barer than that. They're a room full of props with no real story wrapping around them, and then, you know, a sequence of puzzles with no real explanation. And it's a little bit depressing, in all honesty.
Yeah. I mean, like, as a puzzle person, that appeals to me a lot, because solving puzzles is like scratching an itch, basically. You know, it's extremely satisfying. The other parts of me as well, like the part of me that's gone to sleep no more 3 times and is sort of like ready to go back. I very much am like, but why? Why?
I love Punch Drunk's stuff. We've had I don't know if you came across The Drowned Man over here or heard of it.
I didn't make it while it was actually running, but I've heard many stories about it.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic piece of environmental work. Max and Nick, have you come across it?
No, not The Drowned Man. No.
The Drowned Man was essentially I think maybe 4 or 5 story building next to Paddington Station in London, which they did up as a 1930s, possibly 50s, my mind's deserting me, film studio. So they had all the back lots on the different sets, and they also had the kind of small town outside it with all the bars and everything, and maybe a caravan site. And they had a hospital level where some of the actors were being examined and treated, and a desert on the top floor. And you wandered through this, as with all these Punch Drunk productions, kind of following actors as they went around these things, and some amazingly set dressed rooms and some amazing bits of environmental storytelling in terms of documents you uncovered and things that you stumbled across that you shouldn't have, and a vague Cthulhu plot kind of running in the background, possibly. But my problem with those things, and I don't know about Sleep No More, but I've done a few Punch Drunk things down here, is that they feel immersive but not that interactive. It's something that is interesting with the escape rooms, is that they, much smaller form, can be considerably more interactive.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with Sleep No More as well, and as The Drowned Man, as I understand it, they're fundamentally the same. You have this constant awareness that things are going on that you will never see. You will never have access to that one-on-one, or there's just plain and not enough time to be able to dig through all of the drawers and follow all of the things. And, you know, the actors have split off into different rooms, and to me, that's very frustrating. Like, I want to, I'm an exploration sort of style gamer. Like, I want to read everything.
So that's why you go back 3 times?
Yeah. Yeah. and each of those 3 times was completely different. And I wanted different things out of them each time. And, you know, sort of as I grew more and more familiar with how it worked and the layout of the place and things, you know, I was more educated on what to seek out to get that specific experience. But yeah, the escape room thing is like you are being sort of ushered through an extremely specific sort of thing rather than sort of thrown into this that just exists around you.
Yeah, I think it's more my feeling that the Punch Drunk stuff, it's an absolute masterpiece from the point of view of environmental storytelling and from, you know, the stories that are being told. It's the lack of the player's ability to actually affect it significantly in any way, which is, I guess, I've probably just done too much LARP, really. it's interesting because Punch Drunk are, obviously, they're coming from a theatre background, whereas perhaps some of the things I've taken part in are coming much from a kind of gameplay background, and it's the kind of meeting in the middle which interests me.
They did find that was a very true thing. They did a collaboration with MIT Media Lab with the New York one, Sleep No More, where they had some masks outfitted with RFID sensors that would cause things in the environment to react. Like you'd walk into a room and a book would fly off a shelf. So there was a sort of like sub-story little trail that you could follow. And I think also there was a part where you perhaps through a typewriter, were interacting with people online who were watching as this was happening. I think people online could maybe type and the typewriter would spell things out.
Okay.
But they didn't end up sort of introducing that. And I think one of the reasons was they found that people wanted to affect the way that the story turned out. They wanted it to be a game, and it wasn't. It was actually just a story about a doomed person, and everybody wanted to save this person and then was extremely frustrated when they couldn't.
What makes the environmental storytelling in Punch Drunk Stuff so much better than other productions?
Oh, gosh.
Volume?
I'm not sure it's yeah, volume is part of it. I mean, they make everything all work together. I suppose part of it is the fact that you're standing in it. I mean, obviously, most theatrical productions are you're sitting on the stage watching it from a distance. This, you are in up close. It's like exploring Rapture in Bioshock. You are leafing through people's goods and possessions and documents and, you know, all of this. And it's quite full of gaps necessarily, because otherwise you have to create an awful lot of stuff. But it's, they get everything working well together, like in a good computer game. I mean, they get the art side, they get the sound, they get the lighting, they get the costume, and, you know, it feels like you're there, and that's the difference they make. Is there's nothing in there which makes you suspend your disbelief when you get deep into one of their productions, whereas all too many of these things, even as I said, things like the escape rooms I played, because they haven't got that attention to immersive detail. There are still jarring things which, as Laura was saying earlier, which aren't diegetic, which just kind of throw you out of what's going on. And they're very good at sinking you deep into it.
Yeah. I mean, you physically cross a threshold. I don't know what the sort of surrounding material was for the drowned man. But for Sleep No More, when you enter, you know, you drop off your bag and coat, so you're suddenly unencumbered. You go through this sort of dark winding corridor, and, you know, like the theme from Vertigo is playing, and you emerge into this speakeasy type bar. There's a live band, everybody's kind of mingling around, and you're given a mask. So when you actually enter into the space, it's extremely disorienting. You go in this elevator, you are not quite sure where in the building you are of these five or six floors. I'm not even sure how many floors it is at even now. And then everybody in the audience is wearing this mask. It's, you know, this removal of identity that happens. And again, yeah, there's nothing in there that sort of draws you out of that world. Once you're in there, you're literally transported into this other space. And I also think, you know, they've left those gaps. They draw on a lot of archetypes. Sleep No More is Daphne du Maurier stories as well as Macbeth. So, like, it's all very sort of dark and tense and, you know, about like masks and identity. But they're also relying very heavily on sex and death, right? These sort of like primal things, which is something that you see in horror as well. You know, they're very, very easy to evoke. You're in a dark space. Everything feels sort of tense and dangerous. And you don't know if it's sexually dangerous or like violent, physically dangerous. But there's definitely this sort of like rumbling tension that's happening. And I think that speaks to something like very primal and fundamental in the human brain. And that's why people love haunted houses. You love to be frightened in some way, and why horror movies have so many things that are both murderous and also sexy. It's something that plays out in escape rooms. I've never really seen like a ton that rely on sexy themes. I shouldn't really say that. I just played one that was sort of like Love Hotel themed. But that was the first one I'd ever seen. But many, many, many of them are sort of reliant on horror themes. And it's just because those sort of responses, I think, are very easy to evoke environmentally. And it's something you're seeing in VR as well. Like, it's very easy to do claustrophobia or jump scares, or, you know, the use of lighting to sort of make you feel tense and afraid is like very, when you're first starting out, when you're just sort of like trying to structure something basic, like that's a really easy thing to go for. Not that it's not complicated or interesting. It's just easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to go back just a bit. When you're talking about the more bare escape rooms both of you have encountered, mm-hmm. are those still effective for you two?
From my point of view, they're effective intellectually. In terms of, you know, solving the puzzles. But I do, and from a teamwork point of view, to be fair, but I do come out of them quite depressed and going, if they'd only done this and added this and this bit of set dressing. And yeah, so equally frustrating, but frustrating on a kind of creative level rather than on a puzzle-solving level. On a puzzle-solving level, they're fine.
Yeah, okay. I would definitely agree. And that's something, you know, we're working on another one. We've actually just started, and that's one of the things that we've had to talk about, like, you know, how deep into the story versus experience are you going? Because the people who are sort of just casually interested in these don't really necessarily even know the difference. They might not understand why they have a lingering feeling of frustration or that it didn't kind of cohere. They just, because mostly you do have fun, you know, you're hanging out with your friends, you've done this thing, and maybe you didn't make it out, but maybe you did. They're fun separately, but it's a completely different level of understanding them.
And I don't think you get those moments that we were talking about earlier in the same way. Yeah. And that's maybe why they aren't as memorable.
Yeah,
I think a really good parallel in games, just a good example in computer games. Have any of you guys played The Room by Fireproof, that series on mobile?
No, not yet.
No, think the puzzle box from Hellraiser. So you start with a puzzle box, and then you start to unlock the puzzle box. And it's a sequence of puzzles. The whole three games are a sequence of deeper and deeper puzzles. Obviously, when you open the first level of the box, there's something inside that you have to open, et cetera, et cetera. But they do some very, very subtle storytelling that's kind of just built around what's happening with the puzzles and the design of the box itself, the styling of everything, the iconography, all of that kind of stuff. And they never explicitly say, here is the story, but you come out of kind of the third game very, very clear that there's something horrifically dark and mysterious wrapping around all of this. And they do it without any characters. There are a couple of letters and things, but the bulk of that experience is coming from the environmental design and the atmosphere, and it's a wonderful, wonderful set of things to play through. I highly recommend them.
Yeah. Yes, especially if you're a Myst fan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Put it in the show notes. Ian, how has your work doing live action events influenced your video game work, or has your video game work influenced your live action work?
Well, I think mainly the work that I've done on putting together stories which feature people who could go off and do absolutely anything at all is really useful when you come to computer games and you realize that you can filter them down and funnel them a lot more than that. So, but basically the method of story creation that I was talking about earlier, the kind of moment based stuff, I think has been a really big impact on how I put together computer game story now. And there's all the associated things that you learn in doing things that are live, and theater and film in terms of character design and development. And motivation and framing stories and the atmosphere that go alongside them and environmental storytelling. I mean, obviously, we've done huge amounts of physical props for these games that then when you come to design the story for locations in computer game, it's a very, very similar process. And it's a lot easier in computer games to draw attention to some of those things, to highlight them, pick them out and guide the player towards them and sort of guide the player's footsteps. And it's much harder to do that in a live space. So in a way, some of the stuff that I've learned that becomes easier when you move into computers. Obviously, there's a whole set of other problems that come then, like you're constrained by budget and can't let them do absolutely anything in the world. But the fundamental looseness of writing for LARP, the adaptability of the storylines and realizing that they could come out with a variety of different outcomes and how do you reconnect those nodes works very well in computer games, that experience.
I was just going to add, people are very, very creative about finding ways to break things in real life. So it's like the physical props thing is like a distinct challenge. That's also been new to me, like in terms of designing for people's curiosity in that way.
I say the same is true for video games too. People always trying to break things too.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that again comes from the live action stuff is people are always very willing to break things, but break story and do what they can to break the story. And it might, I mean, obviously I can only talk from my perspective, but it might give you, when you come to design something like a computer game, you maybe start to see some of the edges of the things that they would try, the edge cases that maybe if you're just thinking about an almost linear story, you don't think about some of those edge cases. And I think the experience of having a bunch of players who could conceivably just completely floor you by doing something you never expected means that you might have more of an appreciation of the range of things they might come up with when they're trying to play a computer game.
Yeah.
Laura, have you tried to break Sleep No More anytime you've gone there?
yes, I would say. I mean, you know, you sort of naturally... So there's a thing that happens. If you've got your mask on, you know, there's sort of a group of people clustered around an actor, right? That's generally... Anytime you encounter a scene, that's generally what's happening. And it's actually very difficult at first to make yourself not sort of participate in that. So you have to sort of train yourself to deliberately go against that. And whether that means one of the things that I did the second time that I went was anytime I encountered a crowd, I turned around and went the other way. I was actually at that time just looking for empty spaces. I wanted to sort of take in all of the set design and the environment and be able to dig through desk drawers and like rifle through people's jacket pockets and things. So for the way that space is designed, that's considered an unnatural behavior, but the environment supports that as well. So I don't know, does that count as breaking it if they've accounted for people who are trying to do those things, you know? There was a rumor online that there was a sort of like meta game where if you could collect all of these sort of objects by different actors, you know, sometimes they'll give you a gift of a necklace or a charm or something like that. You would get access to, you know, some sort of special room. And there definitely is occasionally a time when one player is taken off into a separate floor, a separate room. And I'm not sure if that happens every time or not, or, you know, how rumor-based this actually is. But again, like, you know, people try for that. So they're playing the game, as it were, to try and achieve those sorts of things. But it's also a part of it. So I'm not sure how game breaking that is. Yeah, I do. I try all of the doorknobs, and I try and go down the corridors where people are like sort of, they have handlers there with black masks on to sort of like usher you. And it's for safety as well. But they try and keep you from like going into spaces. So I definitely attempt to push the boundaries to figure out what is actually acceptable or not. There's also a sort of natural crowd behavior that I think happens where everybody hangs back a little bit from where actors are, but you don't actually have to do that. And when I figured that out, that's how I started getting the one-on-one interactions that are sort of famed and rare, like not being pushy, but you don't have to sort of sit with everybody who's just like watching from the edges of the room. You can go up to the actors and sort of move around them and read over their shoulder if they're looking at a letter. And you know, my favorite one-on-one that I got is because I had gone up on the stage at the very far end behind a room thing that was happening at the opposite end. And then I was stuck there when other actors came out and began to perform there in front of me. So I wasn't technically supposed to be there, but by being in proximity to the actors in that moment, I got access to a completely different storyline in a different part of that world. So, yeah, it's facilitated.
There's a couple of fascinating things there. I think the masks are amazing because so the general public, when they come in, will be handed, I don't know what it was with Sleep No More, but we've done Punch Drunk things where you'd be handed an anonymous kind of Venetian mask, just blank, pale. We're also given a cloak. But the really interesting thing that happens when people put on that mask is they kind of fall silent. And they become almost part of the scenery, because when you're looking around trying to examine the environment, if you see one of those faces, you automatically tag them as audience and you kind of erase them from your experience. And it's almost like this invisible wall is put between the performers and the audience, but nobody ever states that. It just happens, and that I think is a fascinating piece of psychology, and it only takes an effort of will such as what Laura was doing to break that wall. which I think is an amazing kind of bit of discovery by these guys. The other thing I think is fascinating is the one-on-one conversations. And this kind of came from having spent an awful lot of time setting up a big set piece with lots of art departments on one of the games that we did years and years ago. And then in the end, only six people saw it. And I was terribly disappointed that only six people had managed to get there and see that thing. And it wasn't until years later, really, that I started to realize that didn't matter in any way. Because we were talking about war stories and froth earlier. What happens is that tale kind of grows in the telling. And you hear these amazing stories about who was there, despite the fact that they weren't, and what actually happened, which is far more exaggerated than ever happened. And I think exactly the same happens with things like the punch drunk one-to-ones. They're amazing. Those private moments form kind of amazing story seeds, which kind of grow. And I suppose going into computer game design again, they're kind of like Easter eggs, I guess, or special secret endings or whatever. And the interesting thing about computer games, of course, is once that information is out there, anybody, if they try hard enough, can get in and experience those things.
Yeah.
Or the hard thing these days is now, like, if people hear about something like that, they'll just try to mine the game itself too and brute force it and steal it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. It's true.
As a funny side note, like now I think it's super interesting that people will go through the code of the game to figure out all of the secrets of it. That's just happened with Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
To sort of uncover like what are the mythic animals. But it happened with Spelunky too. There were things that Derek Yu had put into that game and then just didn't tell anybody because he wanted them to have the joy of discovery. And I should actually plug his book for Boss Fight that he's written about Spelunky because it's super, super good about the sort of joy of game design of putting in moments where people can sort of uncover things for themselves. And it's super interesting. But he's done that on purpose, but it was only discovered when people actually went into the source code to find there was a thing drawn on a sprite sheet that people uncovered and it unlocked this entirely, totally different experience of that game.
It's kind of interesting, though, that, isn't it? Is it just as much of a wonderful private discovery if you stumble into it during the play of the game, or if you stumble into it because you spent a lot of time going through the source code? It's an interesting kind of thing. Treasure chest, you know?
Yeah. When you're making live action experiences, you can't control what people do, so how do you write for that?
Well, I will say, for escape rooms, it's very different because you are trying to usher them through an extremely specific experience. We've structured ours so that there are several paths that are always going at once of different puzzles that could potentially be solved. But everything is gated. So like there's pieces of information without which you cannot proceed. And so, you know, it's structured in ways there's things going on several things at a time. Then there's moments where everybody is brought together at least twice to look at something and sort of group participate before going away again. The gating is a part of that. And then also we wanted people in our room to actually get out, which I think is a different approach to many of the games that I've played. Some of them are sort of like notoriously challenging. They have a 2% rate of escape out of, you know, the thousands of people that have done it, which is fun. It's a challenge. That's a different sort of type of play than the one that we wanted. We wanted everybody to at least get to 75% of the story. There's a certain plot point that happens. We wanted everybody to at least see that because, you know, it feels sort of big and epic and it's fun. But once you start watching people going through these things, they get stuck on different sorts of stuff. But pretty much everybody gets stuck on something. So we have sets of hints that we provide to people. No matter how well they are doing or how poorly, you know, everybody gets hints. Nobody has ever gotten out of ours without one. And we've actually taken the hinting philosophy from the way that Puzzled Pint is run, you know, because there are friends in that sort of like where we cut our teeth on puzzling as a group. And their sort of approach is take a hint if you're not having fun. You know, it's not meant to frustrate you. It's not meant to thwart you. Like, it's not you versus the room. You should enjoy yourself. So we provide hints to people whether or not they're doing well. Regardless, if they are not having fun, we send them. And so there's a sort of like pre-written but malleable set of things that we send to people because we want them to get through that experience. So like in terms of like the narrative writing, that's all pretty much set. And we're trying to like get you, you're never like skipped over any of that, that part of it. But there's like a very fundamental set of things that we want people to experience. And then everything else is sort of like getting them to there.
Ian?
Yeah. It's tends to be very different from the escape room. So when we're constructing these sort of stories, what we try to do, I talked about the moments before, obviously we try and sketch out these moments and we put them in, if you like, an ideal order of what we'd like to happen. And those tend to be wrapped around things like physical sets or particular special effects, particular stunts and whatever. We cluster them around those because each of those needs a setup of some sort. It will need the art team to go off and spend three hours putting all that stuff into the right place, you know, moving all the projection equipment, setting off pyrotechnics, all that kind of thing. So we tend to have these very, very set points. But we're quite flexible about as and how and when they actually happen. We might structure a game around almost like a kind of hub system. So you have a kind of central area, and then the players taking part will say, well, we want to go and visit this thing. In the case of the pulp adventure I was talking about, they could fly off to a foreign country and go and dig in the sand there, that kind of thing. So we would have maybe half an hour, an hour's notice that they were going to go in that direction, and then we'd go and prep everything for that and get everybody in the right costumes and that kind of thing. Or, for example, we did a Christmas ghost story not that long ago, and that's really nice structurally because everybody understands how Christmas works. They know the different points where the gift giving is. You know, Santa Claus will be there and whatever at night. And you're going to have dinner, and it's very, very structured, and so we can use that structure to loosely say, in this area of the game, whether it's a time area or whether it's a geographical area, this stuff is going to happen probably. And then our main steering point is actually our supporting cast, because we have a bunch of supporting cast, some of whom are clearly not players. They're people that they interact with, which might be the butler and the rest of the serving staff, or might be kind of supporting background characters or the antagonists in say the pulp game. And obviously they can steer the plot to a certain extent, because obviously our main characters are ordering butlers around and kind of directing things, but they can nudge things and suggest and push things and drop hints if need be. But equally, we also tend to put in a few, only a handful of stooge characters who everybody thinks are players, but who we have a certain measure of control about. We try not to make those the controlling characters of the group, but if we need one of them to do something which will push plot in a particular way, not to railroad it, but just to make life easier for us when we're trying to set up these kind of other situations. But invariably what happens is around the Saturday night of a long weekend event, it'll all go off the rails because they'll have done something that we'd never even dreamed they would do. And we tend to have kind of 3 a.m. meetings of, well, what the hell do we do? How do we pull this back on track? And always what comes out of that is if we've written the character motivations of the antagonists, of the supporting characters, of the kind of staff around you, if we've written those characters strongly enough, we always come back to, well, how are those characters going to react? And when we go with that flow of how those characters will react, we find a way to get the story back on track, or often a completely new track. And often we'll find a way to take some of the later set pieces, which we know we want to have. We'll find a way to twist those to become a new set piece to fit that new piece of story. We'll change the characters involved, for example, or we'll change the timings of it. We'll change the significance or the information that comes out of it. So it tends to be very flexible. We have this bag of stuff which we hope will happen. We loosely plot it out. And then, as I said, we try not to railroad, but we try and hint and push and nudge a little bit. And if it's going completely differently, we go back to character motivations.
After an experience is completed by people, do you ever adjust them based on how the playthrough went through, or do you keep it the same and see how it goes like with the next couple of playthroughs?
We never do more than one playthrough. We throw everything in and go for broke. By the time we get to day 4 or 5 of something, the art department have taken apart all the props from day 1 and cannibalized them into something else. So, you know, it's kind of, we put so much energy and effort into these things that we never want to run them again, because it'd be a different cast, it'll go a different way, And we kind of feel it's a kind of, you have to really be in the moment. A bit like the arcs that Laura was talking about earlier. You have to have this one experience and repeating it. It becomes a bit like when I was talking about producing a whole bunch of identikit props earlier. It's not something we ever really want to fall into.
Okay. Same question for Laura. Do you adjust the escape rooms after people come through them, or does it mostly stay the same?
Well, we play test extensively. First, everything is built sort of just in paper form, and we run people through it because, honestly, as like what I was saying before, people are extremely creative in breaking things. So you want to get all of that out of the way as much as possible, just sort of in the design, before anything even is constructed at all. And so in those paper things, you tend to watch people solving stuff, and it's like a very hard urge to overcome to provide the answer for them when people just aren't getting it. So it's sort of like you sort of have to train yourself out of a lot of your natural reactions to like getting people to get through it. Because when people are stuck on a puzzle, usually it's not the person. It is usually that the puzzle itself is poorly designed. Puzzle designs as well are usually quite easily adjusted by either adding information to make them more simple and more understandable, or removing information to make them more complicated. So yeah, we basically like want to get all of that out of the way long before anything is actually built. But then we tend to run multiple versions of it with people actually in a physical space and with prototype objects, again, to see how things break. And I will say, when we actually, we had gotten through this, like, I'd say it probably took 9 months from the time we had the idea to the time we actually had built everything and it was in our space and, like, ready to go. We brought a whole bunch of our game design friends in, so it was, like, the final version. And they broke stuff in ways that we had not seen in months and months and months of testing. We were like, oh, well, that's really good to know that we need to hide that cable and put this thing away and this talk about this.
Exactly the same in putting your computer game on a show floor for the first time and giving it to someone to hold. And the very first playthrough will always be completely different from what anybody sane would do, you think.
Yeah, exactly. And that, that's even without like the physical stuff breaking. Like padlocks are extraordinarily unreliable and fiddly, and this is sort of like a tangent, but like part of the thing that I think is really important in the design of these spaces is like, if there's a key, there needs to be only one keyhole, unless the puzzle is you have 50 keys and you have to decipher which one is the one that fits in that keyhole, or one key and 50 keyholes. It's kind of a lazy way of gating stuff to just slap a padlock on everything. And especially if it's the same padlock, when you get a code, you never quite know which one to try. So in all of our work, if you get a 5-digit letter code, there's only one place that you can enter that, so that you, maybe not even consciously, but you are aware when you encounter that, that those fit together. But there just are not that many padlocks in the world, many different styles. And there's a lot that require you to, for example, like squeeze it before it will pop open, or like tap it twice to reset it or something, which are all very game breaking. So like that becomes like a really annoying and complicated constraint of like building in real life and having to deal with that sort of thing. Because, how do you, there was a moment in a room that I participated in. I should also add, in our rooms, there's never an attendant in there with you. We place people in there. We watch them with cameras. But having a person sort of watching you changes the way that you play. Everybody sort of looks to the person for permission before they touch things. And also, like, if the person says, like, if they shake their head, like, no, don't touch that, they'll sort of move away from that puzzle completely. So it sort of, it very much like breaks up the flow and sort of takes you out of that space. But I was in one that did have an attendant, and there's this padlock that's a directional sliding thing. So you can like push it and it goes, north, south, east, west, which is like great for puzzle design. Like that is so good, except that once you've slid it, you can't reuse it without squeezing the latch twice to reset it. And like, how do you put that into the game? and explain that in a way that makes any sense at all? Like, do you tag it? Is there a label? Like, do you teach people before you go in, which then spoils the experience of encountering that, you know, that kind of thing. So we had to totally bail on using that particular padlock, which was a bummer.
We came across exactly that same padlock in an escape room.
Yeah, so padlocks are sort of the bane of that sort of world, I think.
We touched upon this briefly earlier, but since both of you have been working in VR, what are your thoughts on VR storytelling now that headsets have been out in the wild for a bit and we're slowly getting out of growing pains with it, with developers?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I don't think people really know what they're doing yet. And won't for a long time. My feeling is that too many people coming from a games side who have been working on learning how to turn games into cinema for a very long time are discovering that those lessons that they've been faithfully trying to draw on, things like, you know, camera framing and the way you do cuts and all that kind of stuff, just don't apply in any way at all. And likewise, people coming from film are discovering that they don't know anything about it at all. And actually, what very few people seem to be saying is, to me, it's theatre in the round. It's much, much closer to theatre in the round. You can't draw a player's attention to a particular spot by turning the camera, for example. You just can't do it. So you fall back on the sort of tricks that we've been talking about in escape rooms or in Punch Drunk or whatever, where you have a plot point happening, then you have to draw the player's attention to it by, for example, the sound or change in lighting or something like that. But fundamentally, they could be looking in a different way. Or you have to make it happen specifically in the direction that they're looking. And you have to fundamentally think that they might just miss that piece of information. You can't ensure that they will see it or discover it. So maybe you need to be writing in such a way that if they miss one piece of information, it doesn't break your whole story. And I think really going back to theatre and going back to stage is far, far closer to what we'll be doing with VR than a lot of the things that people are trying to do. But it's got better now, but certainly when the headsets first came out, I saw far too many going, oh, let's adapt our first-person shooter. And it's just not that medium. It's a completely different thing.
Yeah. I 100% agree. Like as you're saying, there's a language of cinema that filmmakers have been able to rely on for so long as a shorthand, and everybody who's experienced film is familiar with, you know, what visual cues mean and camera angles and stuff. And so there's definitely a sort of new, I would say even a cognitive-based language of storytelling that's starting to come out. And it's like heavily rooted in theater, absolutely. There's a game called Sisters, which I think is a very good example of what's called directed attention, right? Things don't sort of trigger until you've like passed your eyes over something. Lightning will flash or things will illuminate in a certain way to draw your attention through it. But again, like what we were saying before, it's a horror game because that sort of thing is like very easy to evoke. You're sort of speaking in a brain language almost of, you know, the sort of thrill of anticipation or worrying if there's a jump scare. I've played a lot of games in VR that are well designed, but then you sort of hit this point where you're like, all right, I'm have to trigger this thing because I can't progress without triggering it. So what am I trying to trigger? And like, it becomes a very frustrating exercise. It doesn't feel natural. And like, you're sort of removing agency in that way, which I also think is the problem with, using 360-degree videos, because there's lots and lots and lots of things to look at, but you're not in that world. You can't sort of approach anything and look at it. And that's very limiting. It's like, why does it need to be in VR? You know, that's something I think a lot of people aren't quite asking themselves. Like, does this actually need to be in this environment and sort of, you know, have this amazing, huge toolbox of potential things? Like, would this be better served in a different medium with less interaction, a flatter screen, that sort of thing?
Yeah. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens, and I don't think I've seen anything convincing yet. The point you made about horror is actually really interesting, because I've had a couple of friends playing VR experiences recently, and the VR experiences weren't horror, but they were waiting for them to become horror. because there was something a bit unreal about the setup. The characters were maybe felt a bit creepy, and that feeling of being in a space which isn't real and there's something false and constructed about it, I think evokes a certain amount of creepiness and horror anyway, and you're almost waiting for things to crawl out of the walls. So it'll be really interesting to see how well people manage to create experiences which aren't horror and evoke completely other experiences.
Yeah, definitely. I every time I've seen VR demos happening, there's somebody who comes up and says, "Is this scary?" And I think there's actually sort of a little bit of a culture war happening in the way that VR is being portrayed, because a lot of the videos that you see of people experiencing it, because that's the other part of it. Like, there's this sort of weird performative thing of, like, there's a person in this huge bulky thing and everybody's sitting around watching them or watching the screen to see what they're doing. All the videos that I've seen of people interacting with VR are them screaming and ripping the thing, you know, the headset off their face or running into a wall or something. And, like, I haven't actually seen a ton of positive portrayals of people interacting with something that feels really magical. I was really excited by the Fantastic Contraption mixed reality videos that they were doing, because that actually gives you a real experience of what it actually is like to be sort of like moving around these objects. And I think the Tilt Brush videos as well kind of convey that stuff, but they're the ones of users doing it, because filming mixed reality is so complicated. It's all horror stuff and it's all scary, and I think that's really off-putting. I actually really worry about that, because I don't want it to become a self-reinforcing thing where people are like, well, VR is all horror and I'm not interested in that, so I'm not going to play it. Then that leaves only the people who are interested in scary stuff. Then all the content that gets made is just the scary stuff. And, you know, it just will perpetuate like that. I worry.
I think it will get there. I mean, and it's by no means everything is horror. It's just there is this undercurrent, I think, when people try and recreate reality. There are a whole bunch of things out there which aren't reality and are clearly not reality and are actually really cool. Things like Keep Talking and No One Explodes. Have you seen that one? I was going to say, I think I was looking at the Oculus, is it Crescent Bay? The latest prototype was before it went consumer. And we were run through a whole sequence of different demos. And, you know, there was a dinosaur chasing you and all these kind of things. It was a load of short demos. And the one which I actually found most charming, I guess, and fascinating, and made me go, oh, there's a whole lot of potential here that I wouldn't even have dreamt of, is you are kind of standing in the middle of nowhere, and there's a little land floating in front of you, just a little kind of open land with grass and little windmills and smoke coming up and trees and roads, and suddenly you start thinking about board games. And that's crazy, using something like VR for board games. But if you were to imagine something like Populous or something like that, where you can kind of infinitely scroll the land in any direction, it's just that sense of looking down and seeing this miniature, almost playset, toy set in front of you was a completely different side of VR that I'd never even considered. And it felt like there was something really quite magical about that. And it'd be nice to see whether people do anything with that, because it gets around all sorts of things. Like, you don't have to walk anywhere. There's no first person body issues to worry about really at all.
Right. Exactly. It's funny that you mentioned that, because in the project that I'm working on, we play with scale in a not dissimilar way, in service of storytelling.
Okay. Can you say what you're working on, Laura?
Sure, I can talk a little bit about it. It's still sort of in the planning and prototype stages, so I don't want to like commit to anything.
Sure.
We're working on something that involves something that I'm really interested in and just like my personal work, which is like, you know, reading through letters and sort of diegetic objects as a way of like telling a story. But it involves traveling through time in order to learn about a person's life. And it's sort of focused around one specific environment throughout this sort of set of points in time. And so we were just wondering, you know, given that you can do basically anything in this thing, like, why would you just have somebody walking around a regular room? Why wouldn't you have them able to either make it a, you know, miniature and be able to observe it as if you were a giant, or to be able to expand it so that you're child-sized within this. So you would be experiencing this physical space in this person's life as a child, as an adult, and then sort of on a meta level, like as this person who's exploring the story and doing this research and putting all of the pieces together.
Cool. How far along are you?
We're still talking about stuff, talking through things. I'm writing out the prototype tech demo right now.
Okay.
So basically like the first 10 minutes of the game that you would experience. But we know the story. We've talked through all of that. I'll know when it's set, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Question for both of you. Have either of you seen any kind of like shorthand appear for VR yet? Or feel like there's a shorthand appearing in terms of mechanics or controls or stuff like that?
Sorry, Laura, go.
No, I was some of it. There's a tension right now between like room scale VR with like the Vive and experiences where you're seated with a controller or standing with a controller, as sometimes the case is with the PS stuff. So there's different methods that are being used for moving you around in the space, right? Like you pull the trigger, you get this little arc that drops a circle on the floor, and then it teleports you to wherever that arc is, right? Which is a nice way of being cross-platform. But in room scale, when you actually can like walk around a physical space and, you know, kneel and crouch and peer around things and sort of like put your face right up to stuff, in those games, as soon as you introduce the teleportation thing, people basically stop walking around. So that's something that's really interesting. There's also like people's sort of natural inclination to not collide with objects is not actually necessary. So watching people play, for example, Fantastic Contraption, you have this object that you're structuring and, you know, you're pulling all of these like impossible items out and like sticking them to this other impossible giant build. But people walk around it and sort of peer at it. You could walk through it. Like you don't actually have to go through a huge space. Like you can just sort of pass through. So the way that bodies are being rendered and hands and things to match with that is really interesting. You know, there's the sense of presence, the awareness of your own body in a virtual space, and how that misaligns with something like if you stick your hand out and it does or does not collide with either the physical wall in your own real space, but the hand visually passes through something, or you are moving your hand toward an object and then in the virtual space it collides, but your real hand continues on. You know, those sorts of things are being explored, and it's all very much based in like how it feels. So like there aren't even really words or a vocabulary yet to describe a lot of those things. It's just like being played out. It's super interesting, but that's what I've observed.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I've seen any sort of narrative shorthand appearing at all. I mean, all really, again, very early days. And I was going to mention the teleportation, which is seems to be a good solution for a bunch of things. And on the room scale ones, the idea that when you get too closest to the boundaries of things, you kind of fade in a glowing wall, that seems to happen in quite a few games now. And I suppose the only other shorthand I've seen is the kind of using your head to pick objects, having a ray kind of come out of your eye line and picking objects that way. But really, people are still finding their way to things like there isn't even a standardized set of controllers yet.
Something that I think is also really funny, like in my own personal experience using these, is like I always want to lean on stuff or like place a controller down on surfaces that don't actually exist. Like that's something I was playing the one with the robots where you're an assassin. What was that? Budget Cuts. Yeah, in VR. It's called Budget Cuts. So you're like creeping around this space and sort of like leaning around corners and stuff. And multiple times in that, my brain forgot that I was in a virtual space essentially. And like you try and like lean on a wall in order to peer around it and like fall forward into nothing. There was a moment when you're sort of in this ceiling, looking down through a ceiling tile that's been moved aside, And, you know, you're actually really crouching and actually moving your face around to sort of look and wait for these robots to be moving through the hallways. And I have definitely more than once, like, completely smashed the entire rig on the floor by trying to lean forward to look. And, you know, your brain just sort of forgets that you're in that world and in that fictional environment. After a few moments, you just are so acclimated to it. But that's all just to say, like, in terms of developing these games and an emerging shorthand, like, those are the sort of experiences that you can only get by spending time in it. It's not something that is directly translatable from straightforward video game making or filmmaking or something. It's a completely different medium with its own language that, you know, everybody, I think, individually as a designer has to figure out, as well as relying on the emergent stuff that's being shared.
Yeah, and to go back to kind of old stories, I mean, obviously, when cinema first came along, it was cameras pointing at theatre and not moving, and it took them 30 years to start doing really interesting things with cameras, and I think we're very much in the same place now with VR. It'll take a long time to, hopefully not 30 years, but it'll take a long time to evolve what we're doing with storytelling, and the tech will evolve alongside it. So we'll see. We'll be in a very different place 5 years from now.
Is there any kind of VR storytelling that you see right now that interests you, or are you still waiting for it?
I mean, I've been playing a lot of stuff, and, like, the things that have been released are good. Like, they're all really solid. There's nothing that I would
like
say.
What?
Let's see. I'd have to actually, like, look at Steam and see. I mean, the ones that I found the most fun are like physical games, like Valve's The Lab has a ton of stuff, and it's, like, really, really fun to do archery, or to do, like, there's this one where you're sort of inside the equivalent of an arcade cabinet controlling this little spaceship. Like, that sort of stuff is really fun. And also Audio Shield. They're all really physically tiring, though, I have to say, because, you know, you're sort of waving your arms around, and it's that same problem that was brought up during Minority Report, when you had Tom Cruise doing the sort of, like, conducting of the UI for all of the surveillance stuff, I guess, or the precog, I don't know what you'd call it, the videos that their brains had generated. Yeah.
Yeah, the crime footage.
So, like, actually, it's a physically intense experience, but those are the ones that I've enjoyed the most. There's some storytelling ones that are really interesting atmospherically that aren't necessarily executed that well, which I don't kind of want to call them out, but people are trying. I'd say people are working on it, but it's also it's kind of not enough to just make a cool environment that you can move around in. Like, there's why does that thing have to be in VR? You know, that's what I'm always, like, really interested in. Actually, the chat show that was in Firewatch, I thought was a really, really cool use of, like, you cannot do that thing except in that environment. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, Will Smith's.
The Foo Show thing?
Yeah. I forgot. It's a weird name.
Yeah.
We'll put in the show notes, everyone.
Yeah, Foo Show. Like, for people who haven't experienced that, they're talking about Firewatch in this VR environment, but they actually go into the tower, and you as a viewer, quote unquote, can, like, also move around in the space and pick up the objects and look at them, you know, so you're seeing that it's just the sort of facade with, like, there's no back in it, or you can, like, peer really close at the art on the books or something. But as they're going through and talking about how those things were all designed and crafted, so you're experiencing a physical space that was actually, you know, is built sort of in the appropriate scale. They modeled it after the actual blueprints of real Firewatch towers. But you're experiencing the game objects in a way that you have not previously been able to, and that only makes sense, like, to merge that sort of, like, physical and digital part to experience those things. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah,
but it can't exist other than in VR.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I've not come across that. I'll have to have a look out for it. One thing I did notice playing through one of the latest PSVR demos, which is essentially I was playing it to try out. They've got a new controller, which is a bit like a gun. It's kind of odd geometric shape thing with a couple of thumbsticks on it. And it was for a first person shooter. It was surprisingly good and surprisingly didn't give you motion sickness. But it had a segment in the middle of it. The storylines or the kind of atmospherics, it's very like Halo. So you've got these kind of insect monsters around and that kind of thing. It's that sci-fi environment. And the interesting thing in that was you were going through a segment at one point, and there was a hologram playing of previous mission to this place, and the people in that previous mission are going through the motions that they were doing when they were here. They were recorded. You've got their voices, and you've got all those things happening. And what it really hammered home is that these holograms are normal human scale, and the sense of presence of those characters is unlike anything that I've got from a 2D experience, or from a sitting in the cinema with 3D glasses on. The sense of that those characters are there and are real people was quite astounding, and it'll be really interesting to see how with high fidelity characters that changes just emotional connection between these NPCs. Now, of course, Uncanny Valley is going to play in that, course, but it was just, I had not felt before that real solid, this is a person. And ironically, they were holograms, so you could wander through them anyway, and they wouldn't track your eyeline or anything because they were holograms. But it was just a fascinating insight into a major difference that I hadn't expected, that sense of somebody else being right next to you, I thought was really powerful.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, people as holograms are sort of like particle clouds or something is like the most common way I've seen to like avoid that sense of this is a robot person or there's something not quite right. How close could you get to them?
Oh, you can walk right through them.
Hmm. That's the sort of the personal space invasion thing is like super interesting and weird to me. Like that idea you could just be like peering right into their mouth and like you can put your head through the model of their face. That is always a real strange experience.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that settles down again as people get used to this medium. Because I think one of the things which some of the designers have been talking about is that if you don't give them that space to play, then what people want to do when they get to this environment is play, is pick up very small items and look at them close. I mean, all that kind of amazement of being in a new space and being able to do anything with it. And so they will try and push all of those boundaries and find out where the boundaries are. And it's going to be interesting to see whether that impulse dies away as people get more used to VR, as they go on to their second, third, fourth experience and so on. And whether in 3-4 years time, we won't be designing for that sort of play. We'll be designing for a much kind of more constrained way of dealing with these things because people will have become used to that language. Again, going back to the live action stuff, is what we found is when you've immersed people in the story and the motivations and you've given them their goals and they know what they're doing, they kind of feel in tune with the game, in tune with the story, in tune with the atmosphere, and they will naturally go in certain directions and they won't test the boundaries because they're in the moment, they are their characters. They're in the moment. They know what their motivation is, and they're not going to stop and start pulling things apart and going, "Oh, there's wires behind that." And I think at the moment, one of the activities that people want to participate in VR is that exploration of a new universe. But once we start really getting going on story games, it's going to be about building stories and atmosphere where they don't care about those moments of stopping and searching for things because they're being carried along by the story, they're being carried along by the flow, they know where they're going, they know what they've got to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we're going to wrap this up. So where can people find you two on the internet?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Wildwinter, which is all one word, and I've just started a new company, which is talespinners.co.uk, as in T-A-L-E, spinners, and all over the place otherwise, but those are the two main ones, or obviously Frictional Games.
And Laura?
Also on Twitter, my name is Laura E. Hall on there. That's also, if you go to lauraehall.com, I post completed projects on that site. And so, like, there's not a ton of activity right now because everything that I'm working on is, like, much longer term. But, like, when the book release information is out, it'll be on there. The VR stuff and as well the multiple new escape room things that we're working on should all sort of be focused on that. But mostly I'm active on Twitter, so on that. And our escape room in Portland, Oregon is under 60minutestoescape.com, which is 60 minutes to escape.
Awesome. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at ScriptLockCast. But thank you both for coming on today. This is great.
Thank you. I kind of want to talk for another 2 hours or so.
I know, me too. Yeah. Thank you for having us.
We'll have you both on again in the future then.
Cool. Thank you very much.